Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a pretty dramatic couple of centuries for science, for the breakthrough discoveries, inventions, and innovations that have changed the world. There's more to come, and some of it right in front of us. In 2011, in energy, stem cells, dark matter, we're going to be hearing a lot about algae, ice core samples, space trucks, synthetic biology, supersymmetry, and new batteries. This hour On Point, we're looking at the horizon for the big scientific innovations and discoveries we may see in 2011. You can join the conversation. What are you looking for, hoping for in scientific breakthroughs this year? Could we use some scientific miracles right about now? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear in this hour from Susan Hockfield, president of MIT, celebrating its 150th anniversary this year as an innovation machine. But first, joining us from New York is Mariette DeCristina, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Mariette, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
And from Las Vegas, where he's attending the Consumer Electronics Show, which opens today, is Jacob Ward. He's deputy editor and West Coast bureau chief for Popular Science magazine. Jacob, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
So, Mariette, I'll come first to you. What have we got going? What's on the burner this year? What may we see producing new advances that we can kind of get our heads around in 2011?
Well, as you know, Tom, science improves our world directly, and you've talked about some of the really interesting things there already, and I can't wait to talk about more with everybody here.
Yeah.
And also our understanding about how the planet and how the universe works. So today I'm hoping to talk about findings in medicine that we'll see in 2011. You mentioned stem cells. We're going to see stem cells move ahead a bit this year. How cheaper DNA sequencing will take us to new treatments in medicine. And how we can expect to see a vaccine for hepatitis C, which affects 3% of the world population, probably approved later this year. In the areas of climate and energy, you know, we know, well, climate is has some political controversies surrounding it about...
I'd say.
Say
the least.
But as things go, you know, the truth about it in science is that there's lots and lots of more evidence coming. And I'll talk to you more about some spectacular new findings we'll see this year about measuring how climate was when the world was warmer, what could we expect to see in the atmosphere in the future today, how the magnetic fields can help us see how sea level is actually rising, and other such findings. On the energy side of equations, so while we try to understand climate on the one side with what's happening today, on the other side we're looking for new energy solutions, which I'm hoping we'll hear more about from everybody. But one of them is we can look to see maybe fusion at the new National Ignition Facility this year that's here in the U.S. And also perhaps now that there was that terrific advance last year in what's called synthetic biology, that's taking cells and making them become little factories to produce things for us. We might someday be able to make algae produce fuel.
We're going to dive
in.
Yes, please. Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. And the last category that I want to talk about at some length is that of understanding how the universe works around us a little. And we're going to have some real fun this year in the solar system. We're going to get our first close-up views of Mercury starting in March.
Closest planet to the sun.
The closest planet to the sun is only 33 million miles away, which is like right next
nothing
to the sun
yeah.
in solar system terms.
Right.
We've already started to learn a little bit more about that from a terrific mission called MESSENGER. We may get some insights into something that I'm sure your listeners have heard of but have no idea what it is, called dark matter, which actually constitutes a huge amount of the universe, but we haven't been able to see it yet. We're going to get some insights in that. We're going to learn a little bit more, you know, looking past our own solar system to Earth-like planets.
Everybody's talking about exoplanets
out there. Yes, that's what they're called. So you got the $9 word, exoplanets.
I love that word. Mariette, hold the list right there, because this is a feast, and I want to begin to dive in. Jacob, Jacob, in Las Vegas, let's make it very real here, starting with stem cells maybe. We've been talking and arguing about them for years now. You're looking at things going on right across the country from University of California, San Francisco, to maybe my backyard, where they're talking about, if I've got this right, injecting stem cells into people's eyeballs? Why? What?
Yeah, well, you know, stem cells have been obviously the, you know, the big, just a lot of people sort of pegged a lot of things to it, and I'm, it's very complicated stuff, and so I'm really excited to have so many smart people with us today because I'm going to need all their help.
Okay. But,
I was hoping that would be you, John.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think you and I are going to be punting back and forth as we try and cover the whole breadth of human discovery for 2011. It's going to be rough. But with stem cells, there's just an amazing number of things going on. I mean, you know, obviously the big theme with it in the past couple of years has just been controversy. We've been looking at you know, there's been so much talk about sort of, how, you know, who's going to fund it and how. And, you know, they're talking right now on a federal level about maybe, cutting funding again, preventing.
Yeah, we know that argument is perpetual, but tell us about eyeballs, stem cells injected into eyeballs. What's that?
The big one is there was a clinical trial. They just got approval. Actually, I think I was going to say it may be today, but they just got approval for a phase 1-2 trial in these 12 patients with age-related macular degeneration, which is a
age-related.
Really,
a lot of older people have that, and it cuts into their vision.
That's right, exactly. It affects 10 to 15 million people in the U.S., and they basically will – these patients will receive implants with these certain cells, these retinal cells that are derived from embryonic stem cells. And, you know, if in fact this can bring back eyesight, it will be a pretty amazing thing. There's a couple of limits to know about it. The eyes are sort of, in a way, immune from the body's immune system. You know, they're sort of insulated against the traditional immunoreactions. And so as a result, you know, it's not going to show that you can put stem cells anywhere and have them do anything without the body rejecting them, but it's an amazing sort of first start.
But there are also this year, I think, a dozen or so, 10 other patients who will have spinal injections from stem cells for nerve damage there. Is that the get up and walk again scenario?
Well, it's basically, they have what are called complete grade A subacute thoracic spinal cord injuries. It's basically it's a really bad injury, and this place, the Geron Corporation in Menlo Park, has announced basically that a patient with that kind of injury under treatment at the Shepherd Center in Atlanta is going to enter its study of this embryonic stem cell based therapy that basically could restore some sensation and maybe even some function to victims of this kind of spinal cord trauma. It's a really that would be an amazing thing. If you can not only bring back some, you know, not only stop the damage that's happened, but actually bring back a little sensation, would be an incredible thing.
So that's incredibly personal. Planet-wise, energy is what it's all about. Yes,
Tom, do you mind if I just add one really cool thing about stem cells? I mean,
first of all,
I hope listeners know that, you know, the excitement around stem cells is that eventually you could cure diseases like Parkinson's with new nerve tissue or grow new organs, right? We can't get enough organs for organ transplants. But the controversy, which you guys both alluded to, is the thing I wanted to mention. A very recent finding, which I think we'll see some new results on in 2011, and this is earlier on than what Jake's talking about with the clinical trials. But what this is you could take now, there's scientists who have been able to take adult cells, like skin cells off your finger or something.
So not embryonic, and, not the source
so
of controversy.
So not embryonic, to avoid that controversy, and make those cells restart back to that stem cell stage. And when I say stem cell here, I mean it could become any one of the 220 cells in your body. And that's a fascinating new development, and I think could lead to some advances. First, it will be in understanding diseases, but then maybe later, if these, they're called, I'm going to give you the $9 word, induced pluripotent stem cells, because I think you're going to hear it a lot.
Good.
You're going to hear that term a lot. These are cells that have been kickstarted back to their, you know, their initial stage and could someday be another tool to address diseases.
I want to mention that. Yeah,
we'll hold that one.
Induced pluripotent stem cells sounds great. Energy is what's on everybody's mind, Jacob. What about that front? Batteries, algae, what's going on? Maybe in this year.
Yeah, sure. You know, the battery thing is obviously going to be a big thing. I mean, we are already seeing so many consumer products come out of the market that are taking advantage of batteries in new ways. And obviously cars are the big one, right? So we're seeing the Chevy Volt has just, they've announced that they're going to be selling those this year. The Nissan Leaf, they're planning on selling it, as many as 50,000 of them worldwide.
But we need breakthroughs so those batteries can hold more energy, hold it longer, capture energy from algae or wind or you name it, and drive on it, let's say.
That's right. So the thing, you know, that everybody is sort of worried about with these new cars, as amazing as they are, is the range, you know, the the Nissan Leaf, I think, has something like, you know, it's a little over 160 miles, you know, in a charge, and that's just sort of not quite enough. And the whole problem is basically, how do you get enough lithium into, how do you jam enough lithium atoms basically into a battery to make it work? And we're looking at a number of different, people sort of working on what is the anode that sort of gets that juice out of the lithium.
And, is that going to happen here or in China, where they've got a whole city devoted to battery research?
We think that's a really interesting thing, and my colleague Seth Fletcher has actually written a book called Lightning in a Bottle that's coming out in May that's all about this fight. And basically it's a big problem. American companies represent just a drop in the bucket of battery research that's going on right now, although there is good research happening, and GM is doing a bunch of it. A company called A123 is doing it. But the big ones are Korean and Japanese and Chinese companies. Panasonic is the breakthrough that everyone's sort of waiting for. They're going to be putting out batteries that use silicon anodes that could put 1,000% more power into a battery, but is in fact the first one will be probably 30% more. Panasonic is very tightly connected to Toyota and Tesla, and will probably be doing it there. The funny thing about
is that American technology, Jacob, or who knows?
No, it's in this case Japanese technology.
Okay.
But the Chevy Volt, the battery there is going to be made from a Korean technology there. You know, even the Ford Focus that's coming out at the end of the year is going to also be a Korean-made battery.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the horizons of scientific innovation in 2011. The editor-in-chief of Scientific American is with us, Mariette DeCristina from New York. Jake Ward is with us from Las Vegas. Now he's a California-based West Coast bureau chief, deputy editor for Popular Science magazine. In just a second, we're going to hear from the president of MIT. Everybody likes breakthroughs, and we've got pretty great imaginations about what they might bring us. We're in 2011. Here's the 1985 classic Back to the Future, Michael Fox as Marty McFly, and there's Doc Brown. They're traveling in that DeLorean time machine. They're looking out for the future.
Hey, Doc, you better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Oh, that we wouldn't need roads. Can't happen soon enough. Get off that gasoline. Joining me now in the studio here in Boston is Susan Hockfield. She is president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, which is incidentally celebrating its 150th anniversary over the next 150 days or so. An American innovation machine that was founded by a Southerner in New England 2 days before the start of the Civil War. Susan Hockfield, President Hockfield, welcome. Great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So MIT has seen so many waves of innovation over so many decades, generations now. How do you see us poised here? Are we poised at a fruitful moment in terms of, you know, what's online to come through and maybe change the way we live and work?
Well, I think that this is an extraordinary time for the nation, not just MIT, but the research enterprise that has, as you say, powered up America. And it's not just a intellectual activities. It's not just, you know, the probing of the forces in the natural world and understanding them, but it is developing the kinds of innovations that, frankly, have fueled our economy profoundly, and not just over the last 50 years since World War II, but it was the reason MIT was founded. William Barton Rogers was interested in founding a university that would accelerate the industrial revolution in America.
So then it was, practices in factories and railways and mines and shipyards, and we've
Absolutely.
Come a long way since then. I mean, MIT was in on the development of radar, successfully synthesizing penicillin, the guidance systems that got us to the moon, and on and on and on. So where do we stand now? Is this a fruitful moment? I mean, we need something to rock and roll here, and people are hoping, particularly on energy, but not only there, that science will come through for us. Is this a promising moment? Is science up to the challenge that we're all sort of – the challenges that we're all staring at?
Well, I think science is up to the challenge. I think the people in the United States are up to the challenge. Our great question right now is whether Congress is up to the challenge.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we have invested an enormous amount in research and development in the United States. Unfortunately, those investments peaked in the 1960s when you look at them relative to GDP, and they've been dropping ever since. We had a great shot in the arm through the congressional allocations last year with the stimulus funding, but the deficit has really focused the mind. And one of our concerns is that the enthusiasm for decreasing the deficit would cut the kind of seed corn that we rely on to actually grow our economy.
You've got conservatives out there saying, don't do that, Republicans. George Will writing, you know, we've got to invest in science here. And looking back at the numbers, American federal support for research in physical science as a percentage of GDP, down 54% in physical sciences, 51%. This is from 70 to 95, down by half in engineering and right on down. So are we, you know, you say it's a great moment, but we've already seen big cuts in what we're investing in this. So there seems to be a gap there.
Well, and at the time that the United States is reducing its investments, other countries are racing to try and repeat the miracle that was the American innovation-based economy following World War II. So it's an exciting time because we've got great discoveries, we've got a lot of enthusiasm, we've got brilliant people at work, and we have really great competition coming from other countries. I personally think the competition is a good thing, as long as you're prepared to compete.
You're a neurobiologist by training. You've got rocket scientists and everything else around you at MIT and across this country, terrific research universities. So what do you see coming sort of on the next frontier, on the next horizon for scientific innovation, maybe this year?
Mariette and Jacob have touched on a number of the most exciting frontiers. I think there's a lot of potential and energy. Happily, people have really been focusing on it. We talked a little bit about batteries in the previous segment, and energy storage is the rate-limiting technology for all alternative energy solutions.
That's because you can't put a wind farm on the back of a car.
You can't.
You can't drive it on solar panels, not yet anyway.
And you can't drive it on solar panels at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to store that energy and store it more effectively, more efficiently is the key. 160 miles, most of us will fill up our gas tank when we're down to about 160 miles of
right.
capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So some of us feel pretty nervous with a battery.
Is lithium still the answer, getting more in there, as Jacob says, or something else?
Lithium is part of the answer, but we've got people working on developing new materials. Material science is one of the most exciting frontiers, and it's going to change a lot of what we do. A lot of effort at MIT around batteries, around energy storage, but also around energy conversion based on new kinds of materials.
Like what?
Well, you know, we've got a great liquid metal battery that's sodium-based, not lithium-based.
Okay.
Cheaper.
Okay.
We've got a lot of other kinds of technologies coming along that will be the batteries of the future. A123, of course, is a spin out of MIT. And
the big plant in Michigan put up not so long ago.
That's right. That's right. And they're looking at materials beyond lithium. So I think there'll be great breakthroughs. One of the things that has helped us so much in energy research and others is computational power. We've got people who are modeling new kinds of materials, and it's no longer the case you have to build them to understand how they work. You can actually model them.
So math will sort of build what's going to happen before you actually physically build it.
Math allows us to imagine what can happen in ways that are much faster than putting the things together in the laboratory.
So are we going nose to nose with China on this, or are they, I don't know, are they eating our lunch on the battery front?
Well, you know, I think in terms of innovation, that first step of invention, I still think, you know, I don't think, it's just not my opinion, the United States still leads the field. In terms of turning those, you know, great ideas into products and getting those products mm-hmm. into the marketplace, mm-hmm. you know, the Chinese, the Germans, you know,
yeah.
a lot of countries are doing very, very well. And I think that it's a call to action for the United States, you know, kind of grabbing your attention when it's much more economical for people to do much of the manufacturing value chain outside the United States. It's something we're focusing on at MIT.
Is there a scientific way to respond to that? Or is that a political, a social, a cultural challenge?
Well, there are certainly policy issues involved. But one of the things that we're going to be doing over the next couple of years is taking a real hard look at 21st century manufacturing and understanding what we can do to actually do that kind of manufacturing in the United States.
Will any human bodies be involved, or just your computational wizards and robots?
You know, that's a great question, because a lot of the manufacturing innovation that we are thinking about on our campus is kind of jobs-free manufacturing. But the fact is, when you're producing things, there is an enormous funnel of activity, of people, of products that have mm-hmm. to go into that jobs-free manufacturing
yep.
at the
yep.
end. So it would be great for the nation to have new kinds of manufacturing happening here. And I think this new kind of manufacturing will make it more possible for us to have a robust manufacturing presence
in the 21st century. Figure it out, Madam President. Bring it home. What about not just storing energy? Energy is so huge. What about creating energy? I mean, Jacob and Mariette are talking about algae. I don't know what you all have going on. What about energy creation in the first place, before it gets into the battery or anywhere else? We need a way that's not fossil fuel-based, obviously. Wind and solar is out there. Not everybody's sure that's going to be sufficient. What about it?
Well, there's a lot of enthusiasm at MIT around many alternative energy technologies. Solar really carries the day. The problem with solar right now is that solar conversion is not sufficiently efficient. It's too expensive. But there's a lot of work on making the conversion of the sun's energy into useful energy more efficient. We're looking at some photovoltaics that can be printed on pieces of paper. You know, these big glass encased photovoltaics are not so easy, not so convenient.
And that's right.
You know, seeing them on
carry around, transport, put up,
exactly,
everything else.
Exactly. So people are working on photovoltaics on other kinds of substances on paper.
You could turn the skin of our buildings into energy creating.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that kind of thing is very interesting. Of course, there's a lot of work continuing at MIT on nuclear power. People are working on making that and have been working on making that more efficient.
What about safe?
Safer.
Yeah.
Safer. And a lot of work on small format nuclear power plants.
The nuclear plant at the end of the block.
Yeah, right.
on Mariette's list, DeChristina with Scientific American, is fusion. And she fusion on Earth. We know it takes place in stars. We've never succeeded in doing it on Earth. What about fusion?
Well, we're still...
Well, we've actually have... I mean, I'm sorry, Susan, because I'm sure you were going to jump in and answer this.
Yeah.
We actually have produced fusion reactions on Earth. What we haven't been able to do is figure out how to get more energy out of those reactions than we had to put in to create
okay,
them.
Right, right. So a net gain on the energy front, I guess, is what we're looking for. Where does that stand?
So theoretically, we are, you know, bullish on fusion, but not next year. And probably not in 10 years or 20 years. You know, realistically, fusion is still probably a couple of decades out.
Susan is quite right. The thing I wanted to mention for 2011 was that the National Ignition Facility probably will get to the point where it can produce a fusion reaction in this coming year.
With a positive
so
energy gain or just a reaction? Or
We hope to see the positive energy side of it, but making then the engineering challenges of trying to turn that into a practical, efficient energy source are pretty heady.
Jacob, you're there in Las Vegas. You've been thinking about algae. There's a lot of things that can happen with it, but is pond scum going to come through for us on energy production?
You know, there's a lot of talk about it. It's a really challenging one. I almost think of it as sort of coda for, you know, how many different ways you can sort of squeeze energy out of what we already have. You know, the thing that's cool about algae is basically if you they just by their nature during photosynthesis they create oil and they store it in sacs in their bodies, and so through various means, limiting oxygen to them and wherever they live or whatever, you can force them to create more oil than they would. And in the process, they're also grabbing carbon dioxide, you know, just as part of photosynthesis. And you know, so they're sequestering some carbon. They're creating some oil. There's, you know, a lot of excitement.
So they could clean up our coal plants, theoretically, maybe someday. This
right.
year?
So, well, there's a couple of interesting things. I mean, DARPA has announced last year that they were beginning a project that we'll see this year to try and create jet fuel out of it, which would be a pretty amazing thing. They're looking to create, I think, 1,000 gallons – or no, I'm sorry. They're trying to create enough to fuel a jet out of 1,000 acres of algae, which would be an amazing thing. The problem, as I'm sure both of my colleagues here would point out, is that, you know, algae is very hard to work with. You've got to cover every surface, and it also tends to block out the very light that it needs after a while. It can't really, you know, sort of pond scum, as everyone knows, kind of grows over. So there's a lot of challenges with it. But I think it just proves it, you know, or shows that there's just so many paths, you know, as Susan was mentioning, to you know, go down in creating energy in all kinds of exciting new ways.
Susan, can you turn a bucket of scum into energy for us?
Well, what we really are working on, and it's a fascinating and productive area, although it sounds kind of boring, is energy efficiency. So the energy
Bring
you don't use is the cheapest energy.
Yes.
And we've got a project on eco-aircraft. And so, you know, biofuels, any kind of fuels in aircraft, it's a tremendous weight. And so even if we were to stay in standard fuels, to reduce the consumption of fuels by aircraft would be an enormous advance. And
so we're going to – I mean, something other than liquid fuel to put in something lighter, in other words.
Well,
maybe.
You know, actually making the engines more efficient.
I
so
see.
You actually require much less of it. And that's going to be, I think, a really great frontier. People get kind of sleepy when you talk about energy efficiency, but boy, there is a lot of energy value to be gained along that strand. Mm,
so sounds great to me. We've got a lot of questions and Frontiers men and women pouring in here. Jeff in Nashville, you're on the air with the president of MIT and the editor-in-chief of Scientific American and popular science man on the West Coast. What do you see, Jeff?
Well, hello. I would like to hear your guest comment on the greatest physical need in the world, which is access to drinkable water. Mm. And particularly, I want to hear about, you know, what's going on as far as the technology and innovations to purify ocean water into drinkable water.
Salt water into potable, drinkable water. I don't know. Susan Hockfield, what about the waterfront?
Yeah, there are a lot of great technologies coming along about water. And it is, I agree with the caller, one of the very most pressing issues. And a lot of new approaches. One uses carbon nanotubes to create channels that can desalinate water more efficiently, more effectively. And, you know, the list goes on. One of the things I'm happy about is in the United States, people don't usually think about water as a limited resource, but it certainly is.
It is
in
even
most
here?
Places in the world.
Oh, in most places in the world.
No, we don't think about it generally here, so it hasn't received the attention I think it should, but it's beginning to, and it's very exciting to see the innovations coming along.
Let me get a call right here from your hometown, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Imran. Imran, you're on the air with Susan Jacob, Mariette.
Hi, Tom. Hmm. I work for the Mass Biotechnology Council, and we actually have several programs that are designed to catapult early innovation that occurs in many of the academic medical centers and try to get them into commerce through either mentoring processes or through partnerships. And one of the things that we see is kind of a fundamental gap in the process of getting those technologies out of academic labs and into startups or into...
Why a gap? You'd think everybody would be very hungry to get them out and going.
Well, so the problem is that, you know, for very small dollars, you know, maybe we're talking $100,000 to $200,000, there needs to be a showing of scientific proof of principle. And if you can get there, then oftentimes that becomes enough to attract further investment from outside parties.
Imran, I've just got Susan Hockfield for another minute. Let me put it straight to her. I mean, thousands of companies have come out of MIT. Is there a problem there in getting, you know, from the lab table to the market?
Well, we've done well, but I think we need to do better. And the caller has called out a very important issue. And we've got a couple of processes at MIT, the Deshpande Center, the Venture Mentoring Center, service simply to get technology, get great ideas into marketable technologies. And I think as a region, as a nation, we need to do more of that to, you know, really accelerate the innovation curve.
We've only got you for another minute, Susan. What's the most important thing for citizens who want scientific breakthroughs that are going to help us deal with a lot of these challenges? What's the most important thing we can, I don't know, push, think about, do, apart from doing our homework, kids, and becoming very well educated? What's most important?
Education is important, but I think national passion around innovation. The nation has to fall in love again with science and technology, not exclusively, but to understand that that has been at the heart of our economic growth. It has been at the heart of our, you know, kind of open education, open advance, social mobility in the United States. And as a nation, I think we need to double down on understanding exactly, you know, where economic growth and bettering people's lives come from.
Have we got the stuff to do it, the spirit, the resources, the readiness?
I think we have the basic elements, but I don't think as a nation we have the focus that we once had. And I think we've got to return to that kind of very sharp, you know, very clear focus on building back an innovation-based economy.
Well, hold that flag high and keep it coming. We really appreciate you being with us today. Susan Hockfield, president of MIT. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tom, pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. MIT celebrating its 150th anniversary this year, founded 2 days before the outset of the Civil War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the horizons of scientific innovation in this new year, 2011. Mariette DeCristina is with us, editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Jake Ward from Popular Science is here. He's in Las Vegas today for the opening of the Consumer Electronics Show there. Let's go to Halifax, Vermont, and Mel. Hi, Mel. You're on the air.
I had a question about an article I read in The Economist a couple of years ago, 3 years ago maybe,
relating to batteries, and it was a Japanese scientist that developed bucky tubes, in other words, carbon nanotubes on a substrate of cellulose. These nanotubes would store electrons that could be drained off either like a capacitor, you know, all at once,
okay,
or drained off slowly. And I was wondering, you know, where in development that project has come.
Yeah, let's see if we know. I hear the clack of keys there. Maybe we're finding out right now. But Buckminster Fuller's bucky tubes on the substrate of cellulose. Help me, Jake. Help me, Mariette. Anything to say there?
This is Mariette talking. I'll just dive in quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know that particular Japanese lab, but you may have just heard Susan mention that they're working on carbon nanotubes at MIT as a potential battery storage technology. So I might check that one out a little bit.
Carbon nanotubes. What do you know, Jake, on this front? Anything?
Well, I do know that, back in June, I believe it was. Yeah, and I also don't know this specific thing, but I do know that carbon nanotubes have been used to sort of boost the power of them. The question is basically like, you know, you're just trying to increase capacity, basically.
Right.
You're trying to get as much as you can out of the lithium. And the thing with these batteries of all kinds is, you know, the demand is so great for the power that they put out right now, but they have to be so conservative in sort of moving it forward. And so I think every so often you're going to hear about these jumps forward, whether using carbon nanotubes or Panasonic using silicon or whatever it's going to be, that could theoretically put an incredible amount of power out of these things. But because, I mean, when you think about it, right, a car is needs to be such a reliable piece of personal technology. The market just won't sustain any failures sort of out in public. And so you're going to see a lot of sort of, you know, closed door research going on before you sort of see this stuff make its way into actual cars. So I think it'll be a while before you see, you know, a carbon nanotube based battery out in the world. But I do think that, you know, when you do see these releases, they're going to be incredibly reliable as a result.
There's so much here. It's hard to hit everything. We've got listeners all over the place. Here's Schuler, a web comment saying, enough already. Where is the flying car we've been promised since the 1950s? I don't know about a flying car. You tell me, but let's get it up in the air anyway. I mean, one thing I know you're looking at, Jake, is sort of the space truck here and how we're going from space shuttle to private space flight now. What is it? They're going to charge the U.S. government $130 million a pop, and they're going to take care of getting stuff up there.
Yeah, there's amazing stuff going on with private spaceflight. And also, hats off to that person writing in, because, yeah, man, I want to know, too. When is the flying car coming?
Yeah, waiting.
With private spaceflight, yeah, amazing things are happening there. I mean, this year is supposedly Shuttle Endeavour's last, last mission. That's the idea. You're supposed to see at that point basically a drop-off. You'll have the United States will have no U.S. Equipment to get us to and from, or anything to and from, the International Space Station. So at that point, the idea is that private companies will take over the shuttling of stuff back and forth to near-Earth orbit. And the company that seems to, is getting the most attention for that is SpaceX, which is had a successful launch last year of it's just amazing when I step back and think about it. You know, a private company sending a rocket into space. You know, if you told me that even 10 years ago, I'd say, forget about it. You're crazy, you know, but it's happening now. So the notion is that, you know, the new NASA initiatives put forth by President Obama had to do with privatizing that near-Earth orbit service such that then federal funds would go toward exploration beyond there. And so you're going to see, I think, you know, I mean, supposedly SpaceX says that it can put a rocket up there for $133 million as opposed to what a shuttle costs, which is about $450 billion. The notion of privatization, sort of making it more efficient. I mean, I think you really could get to a point someday where it's like taking the bus, you know, up to space. That's sort of the, what we're looking at.
Space truck, space bus, and once it's private, who knows where we go. Richard in Williamstown, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Okay. Ordinarily, I wouldn't be involved in discussions with people who are in favor of growth and technology, but as an environmentalist, I think that asteroids are a giant environmental threat, and global warming is a giant environmental threat, and the space program theoretically has answers. If we put a few trillion on things like asteroid defense and a few trillion on things like space satellite-based solar power.
space satellite-based solar power. They both sound interesting. Help me here, Mariette. What about the asteroid front or beyond?
I think what Richard's probably referring to, first of all, is the potential threat of asteroids striking the Earth. I'm not sure if I got that right, but I think that's what he means. And, you know, of course, since we were looking forward to 2011, I don't think we're expecting any asteroids to hit us in 2011.
Good.
But it is a potential threat somewhere down the line, and how we may choose to address that while trying to address all the other challenges that exist right now on Earth is one that I'm going to have to leave to.
Don't we have some kind of space probe out there, though, headed for a big asteroid? Is it what's called Vespa?
We do have a space probe going to take a look at a large asteroid called Vesta that will happen a little later this year. And what we're hoping to do there is not defend ourselves, but learn about these rather primordial denizens of the solar system. They sort of float around and they can give us clues about how the solar system was created and how it evolved and, you know, how it came to be, how it is today. And just a quick note on space solar power. This has been a dream since the 1960s of a certain subset of space enthusiasts. I think it would be amazing and fun if we could do stuff like that. It is quite far out, though, however.
Jacob, talk to us about dark matter. I mean, this is what makes up, a huge portion of the universe, and we've known so little about it, and people are talking about maybe knowing more this year. What's going on there and going on underground, among other places?
Sure. You know, basically, so the notion of dark matter is basically the sort of a missing element in the equation that physicists use to sort of govern everything that they think about when they think about physics. So the standard model of physics basically, is just sort of missing a chunk of calculations. And
like 96% of the cosmos, the mystery meat. Who knows?
That's
what
right.
It is.
What is it that's made up of, what makes up the cosmos? Because we think we think there's this extra stuff out there, but we don't know what to call it. So we call it dark matter. And there's so many really fascinating things sort of coming online this year for sort of looking at it, trying to, find it, detect it. That's the first step, is basically detection. So the way that you do it is you basically need to you're looking for a reaction in xenon atoms you need to basically block out the Earth's electromagnetic interference and sort of any kind of spurious radiation that's floating around the universe.
Is that why they're putting these xenon detectors thousands of feet below the surface of the Earth?
That's right. Basically, like with the demise of the American mining industry has come this incredible opportunity for physicists who need big holes in the Earth to put their to find the silence they need, basically. And so they are taking over mine shafts in South Dakota, in Minnesota, all over the world put these detectors down there. And basically you have these physicists down there just watching for a reaction as as these detectors come online this year. You're just going to hear, imagine a guy with a pair of headphones, or staring at a screen, waiting for the proper reaction. And basically if these particles, which are called WIMPs, which are weakly interacting massive particles, if they, bump by us in the night somehow, they're going to kick off a reaction in these xenon detectors, and as a result, should help if they, find them, which is a big if, it will help confirm things about the standard model of physics that, is going to put everybody sort of on the right path, and people are really, crossing their fingers.
Mariette, we've got big experiments in Italy and Minnesota way underground going on this. These particles could have a single particle could have the mass of a whole planet. If we figure this out, what do we do with that?
Well, I'd like to just add quickly to what Jake said first of all about the timing of this. Mm-hmm. In December, there were already in Minnesota detectors detected two signals that could have been WIMPs. Now, they couldn't make sure that the data they detected was perfectly flawless, so right now they're very provisionally not quite accepting it, as scientists will do. We keep testing things and making sure.
Yeah.
But over the summer, by the summer of 2011, there'll be more detectors online at that underground detector in Minnesota, and I think we may yet this year see some of those signals of dark matter. And what do we get out of that? I mean, that's a great question. One of the things we get out of it is that we get yet another piece of the puzzle, and this is a rather large piece of the puzzle, about how the universe works. And sometimes in our near, day-to-day concerns, we don't know what value that's going to have to our lives immediately, But for one thing, it opens your mind. And for another thing, as we've often found out with research in the past, basic science research in the past, it could well have some kind of implication we can make use of someday in the future.
Well, it can't hurt to know what 96% of the cosmos is made of. But, I mean, talk about taking a big bite out of the apple of knowledge there. Wow. We're way down the road if we discover what the weekly interacting massive particles are, dark matter, WIMPs. Jing Jing in Boston. You're on the air, Jing Jing.
Hello. I think global synergy between USA, Europe, China, and India, and everyone else in the world.
Amen.
The innovation.
Will it work? Will everyone work together? What do you think, Jing Jing? Can it work?
I think discover in USA, invest by Europe because they have more money, and made in China, make it cheaper, and IT is very good in India. So everyone else makes something together, make it very cheap for everyone else.
If I may add this.
Ending?
Yeah, Jing Jing, I guess I like the formula, but we got to have American jobs in there if we can. What do you think, Mariette?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if I may add this, science, if any field of endeavor that we have, shows us how international people internationally can work together toward a common goal. And you can have some people with jobs here in the U.S. and some people with jobs in other places, and each of them specializing in various areas that they're best at.
Well, right. But that's a formula that a lot of Americans have grown leery of because they're out of work. It's the right impulse, but we're not all physicists. How about her formula, Jake? You know, discover it here. I don't know. Invest a lot of euros. Make it in China. Tweak it in India. And can we afford to buy it when we're done with all that?
I mean, I think Jing Jing's point is, she should be put in charge of something here because she's definitely, she's onto something. I do think, though, that, with the things that we're talking about, whether it's something as abstract as dark matter or something as practical as battery development, what we're really doing is fueling the next round of jobs, in the United States. I mean, I think, I can't remember the name of the futurist who said this, but, a few years ago, he said that, in 20 years, a certain percentage of us will be working in jobs that no one from today would recognize, right? That's the sort of the dynamic that we're looking at with all these kinds of discoveries that we're talking about today. And so I think the important thing is to sort of keep in mind that funding these discoveries, funding the rise of a new industry like batteries is going to create all kinds of jobs all through the economic spectrum that are going to be, essential to our future. We talk about future jobs in popular science quite a bit because we're sort of always looking for what is the sort of career track of 2020, of 2025. And I think that you're going to see all kinds of essential, irreplaceable skills becoming part of the curriculum as things like battery technology or algal biofuels or private space flights sort of come online. And so I think it does have to have – it really has to do with, making it a funding priority to, get us back to the kind of innovation, that we had after World War II.
Jing Jing, you're right. Let's all do it together and make sure it works for everybody. Reedland, Iowa. Jerome in Iowa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. On the computer, they got about in 2000 – 2008, they had magnetic motors, which a guy produces enough juice to run his household, and then he also runs a car with it.
This is magnetic energy?
That's right.
I don't know much about it. Let's see if we do. Mariette, Jacob, magnetic energy is a source?
I don't know personally about, specifically about magnetic energy in particular, but I would say that one of the things to watch for in 2011 sort of around, alternative engine technology is a program that is funded by the Department of Energy called ARPA-E. It's modeled on sort of the original ARPA that gave rise to the internet and cell phones and all kinds of other things that sort of began with government funding. ARPA-E, is giving sort of $2 and $3 million grants to these sort of little known inventors in the corners of research institutions or private companies, and is funding all kinds of new amazing engine technologies. There is a great thermal recovery system coming out of General Motors, basically a tech center at GM that uses the heat of the engine to expand and contract basically a pulley system inside to give – it basically derives energy from the tailpipe and puts it back into the engine in a really interesting way. Between that, magnetic – engines. There's going to be all kinds of sort of vibration-based engines. You know, engine technology, I think there's going to be a lot of amazing stuff coming out in this coming year.
And Mariette DeCristina, we've scarcely got to exoplanets, and the expectation, as I understand it, that we're going to hear a lot more this year. We've heard some in 2010 already, but about other planets out there in the universe capable of supporting life.
I think the exciting thing there is we got a tease about an Earth size, you know, I'm going to put quotes around it, potentially habitable planet around a star called Gliese this fall, which may or may not end up being as true as we thought it was initially. Okay. That's one of the other things about science is first you get a finding and then you put it to the hard test over and over again until you find out whether you can really make sure it's there or not. But there's a telescope up there called the Kepler Telescope, which is going to be looking at making a survey of 100,000 stars. And I should back up and say that already we have seen larger exoplanets, things that are the sizes of several times the size of Jupiter in our own, which is the biggest planet in our own solar system, because they're bigger and they're more massive, so that makes them easier to detect. And there are maybe 500 of those. And as Kepler looks at those 100,000 stars, for Earth-sized planets, we could find as many as 100 of them.
That would be a big new field. That may be the hottest real estate market in the coming year, Mariette. Hey, this has been terrific, and I hope we can have you back to dive deeper into some of these. But it's been a great survey of what's coming ahead. Susan Hockfield from MIT says it. It's the national passion for science that will get us over some of these humps, and let's hope we've got plenty of it in the coming year. Grateful to her for being with us, and also to you, Mariette. Just great to have you today. Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American, Mariette DeCristina. Thank you so much for joining us, Mariette.
Thanks so much, Tom. That was great fun.
And Jacob Ward at Popular Science. Good luck on the West Coast. Thanks for being with us today, Jake.
Thank you, Tom. That was great.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.